the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. This morning at Mary Beth Maziar's, and I speak with Megan Kahn, a Park City native who is fighting ALS. Join us to hear Megan, along with her mom, longtime educator in town, Becky Brady. They'll tell the story, and we'll hear more about the fundraiser, Hope for Meg, on October 11th. Then Park City Schools have banned cell phone use during the school day for grades 6 through 12. Digital expert Devorah Heitner, author of Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World, will join us to discuss the topic. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. We'll be right back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziar's.
Today on The Mountain Life, we share the story of Park City native Megan Kahn. She's a vibrant mom, lifelong outdoor enthusiast, and beloved teacher whose life has been forever changed at just 38 when she was diagnosed with ALS. Though the disease is taking away her physical strength, Megan's courage, spirit, and love for her family and community remain unshakable. We'll talk about her journey, the challenges her family faces, and the October 11th event here in Park City, where friends and neighbors are coming together to support Megan, to honor her resilience, and to contribute to the fight against ALS. We're joined now by Megan Kahn, along with her mom, longtime Park City resident and also beloved teacher, Becky Brady. Welcome to both of you.
Oh, Hi, thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's wonderful to have you, and it's humbling to see how resilient you are, Megan. Your diagnosis was about 2 years ago, is that right?
Yes.
Take us back to that day. I mean, it's the farthest thing from anyone's mind. I think we picture things that might befall us. ALS is not one of them, I would suspect.
Not at all. So it started with the drop foot in my left foot. I've been a runner for most of my adult life. So I've fallen a few times running, like 3 years ago. My mom kept telling me, go see a doctor, go see a doctor. And of course, I ignored her for a very long time. But finally ended up going, went to my doctor who sent me to a neurologist. Like, let's see, maybe you have a pinched nerve. Maybe something's going on. Like, okay. So went and got an MRI of my back, nothing. Saw a neurologist who did an EMG on my legs and said, oh, there's something going on in both of your legs. We're going to send you to a neurologist across the hall. So I went on August 10th, 2 years ago. And I walked in and they did a whole EMG on my whole body. And afterward, they sat me down and said, the nurse practitioner said, hi, do you know why you're here? And I said, yes, my foot doesn't work very well. She goes, you have ALS. Wow. And I was alone in this big room with this nurse practitioner. And I had no words. She asked me, do you have any questions? And I said, no, I have nothing to say. I have nothing. And it's funny now because this is the office that I go to for all of my appointments. And it says ALS all over the office. But like you said, it wasn't in my mind at all. So I never, ever thought that there was a process. And at one point leading up to this appointment, I had talked to my mom like, okay, this could be a pinched nerve, maybe MS. And I asked her, I'm saying, what about ALS? And she said, oh no, that's really bad. We won't talk about that one. Great. So that was a shock. And I just remember getting in the car, calling my husband and then calling my mom and just being in shock. I talked to my sister and she said, whatever you do, don't Google it. So of course I got home and Googled it because she told me that. And the life expectancy is 2 to 5 years. And then I threw my phone. And then from there, just been trying to figure out life and figure out what I want to do. I remember telling my mom, I don't want to be the poster person for ALS. And well, I've done a lot for speaking for ALS at this point in my life, and I'm just happy to bring awareness and happy other people are ready to listen and understand it.
Well, Becky, as the mother of Megan, talk about your journey. And I mean, I know that you're getting this community to rally around Megan on October 11th, but I can't imagine, as a mother myself, I can't imagine it.
No, it's unimaginable. And I think that's one of the things too about Park City. rallying around me and Megan. You know, I immediately, of course, my husband and I talked, cried, and then all my good friends there, they're just like, we'll be here. What do you need? Do you need to go? I had a friend say, I'm putting you on a plane tomorrow so you can go up there. Okay, you know, and it's just been a rallying for all of us, but it's still very devastating. I mean, Megan has kids that are 8 and 11. So I try to get up here as often as I can now that I'm retired and just give support for everybody, for her husband who's looking at what this life is going to be like, and for Megan who's still teaching, and that's exhausting with ALS. You know, just trying to be up here for everybody and know that here she has great support too, but we have it in Park City, which is wonderful, the place she grew up in. So that really makes a big difference.
Could you give us a little overview of the typical progression of ALS for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, that's the thing about ALS. So ALS is a very tricky disease. It's really hard to diagnose because it affects people in so many different ways. So I have limb onset, which when it meant that it started in my leg, my foot. And some people have bulbar when it starts in their mouth, their lungs, up in that area. So the progression is different for every single person. My progression has started in my left leg, has gone to my right leg. I'm still able to walk at this point, but then it jumped up to my hands. So now I'm losing a lot of my fine motor. So I would love to be able to say that this is the progression that normally goes, but this is a wild disease and I have no idea where it will go next. I have no idea what will be affected, but at this point I'm just trying to keep walking, trying to keep teaching, and we'll see.
I think one of the biggest things we realized after going through this now 2-year journey, and we went to a big conference in Dallas in August, the ALS Nexus Conference, the ages, people don't realize. They think of this as an old white man disease. And Megan has found it's way different than that. Tell me about the people you found that are under 30 even.
So there's a whole group called Her ALS, and it's women that have been diagnosed before 35 with ALS. And there's a whole network of women who have been diagnosed and young women who are working to find a cure, working to find support for each other. So, and it affects everyone in so many different ways, but there are people in their 20s, or we even saw someone that was had diagnosed with juvenile ALS when she was a child.
Six.
Yeah. I mean, it's really been thought of as a white man, older white man's disease, and an older person's disease as well, because a lot of older people end up getting it. And the reason that the life expectancy, I believe, this is not based on science, but what I believe is because so many older people have things that are failing in their body already, and so you don't go to a doctor. And if I hadn't been as active as I had been, I probably wouldn't have gone to a doctor either. I'm like, oh, something, you know, my foot's just being weird. And so you put things off for a long time. And then as the progression, you're like, oh, is this old age or is this something else? And so being younger, being 38 when I was diagnosed, I thought, well, this doesn't make sense. I've been so active my whole life. So that's what put me there. But I mean, overall, there's people of all ages. We saw someone who was 26 who performed at ALS Nexus. So it is just spreading awareness of this disease and allowing people to understand that it's not just older people and that it's affecting younger people and more athletes, people who have been in service, and then people who are just regular people.
And there's no real big definitive diagnosis or test for ALS. It's just they rule everything else out and it's like, okay, that's what you have.
Which, oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, there's no test for it. So that makes it tough too.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's why people, I think, go from doctor.
That would make sense. Yeah, and because it sounds like the symptoms can be really varying. If you happen to go to a doctor who's not in that specialty, I bet they could miss it.
Absolutely. After hearing so many people's story, been absolutely amazed at how quickly I was diagnosed. I mean, my symptoms started over 3 years ago, But by the time I went to the doctor and got diagnosed, it was within a year that I was able. And so many people I've talked to, it's been 4 or 5 years it took for them to actually get the diagnosis.
And is there an active treatment plan that's effective right now? Or is it like, does it help to be diagnosed early?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, wondering like, oh, I'm so glad that I was diagnosed early. And there's no treatment for ALS. There is no cure for ALS. There are 2 FDA approved drugs for ALS right now. One of them was developed in the 70s and it prolongs your life by mere months. And there is another one that was developed a few years ago that also just prolongs your life by a few months. And there are other drugs for people who have different types of ALS, but for where I am right now, those are the 2 options that I have.
I think what was frustrating too was Megan went right into a trial, which we're like, oh, great, trials. And then tell them what happened with the trial.
Oh, it's really cool. I was part of the Healy trial, which is they've made an umbrella of trials so they don't have to reapply for FDA approval every time. They can just keep putting different trials and trying different things. But the trial that I was on did not show any effectiveness whatsoever. And they like to get people for clinical trials. They want to get people who are within a year or of their onset of their disease. So after I was off the trial of almost a year, I'm now too far in my progression to get on to another clinical trial.
Let me reintroduce both of you. Megan Kahn is joining us along with her mother, Becky Brady. Megan is a Park City native as well. Becky is a longtime Park City resident. They're both teachers. Becky was my son's 2nd grade teacher. They're big family in the community here. Now is a good time to talk about this amazing fundraiser coming up on October 11th on Saturday. It's 2 parts. Tell us more, Becky, and maybe I'm sure you've probably organized this.
Well, no, it was actually my dear friend, as you probably know, people in Park City too, Kathy Anderson, who, great teacher. She was one of my first teaching partners years and years ago. We've known them all our lives. And she really wanted to do something for Megan. As soon as Megan was diagnosed, we're going to do something. So she's pretty much organized this. So what we're going to have is an exercise class at Basin Rec from 9 to 10. It'll be 3 or 4 different instructors just doing various things, you know, with the whole class. And it'll be a donation base. You just donate what you want. So even if you don't belong to Basin Rec, you can still come in and you just donate for the class. And then after that, from about 10:15, we'll have the walk. We'll ask those people if they'd like to come over to Matt Canute Park. We've got the park for that time. And we're going to have a walk around there. And again, we can just go around Matt Canute, you know, and stuff. So it won't be a long walk. And then we're going to have a small silent auction and a bigger opportunity drawing while we're there. And just kind of to celebrate and again, just raise money. And hopefully we have Lucky Ones Coffee that's coming to there. And I have got friends from years of going to boot camp when I was teaching that have made treats. And it's just going to be a fun event for all of us to raise money for Megan, for what all these things they need now.
Let me just mention the website and you can sign up, but I imagine you can just show up as well.
Yes. Yes. The one thing you can't sign up for, show up is probably the thing at the fitness class at Basin Rec, because they have a cap, but I don't think it's not full now. So that's the only thing. The walk, just show up.
We'll be okay. So it's Stronger Together for Megan. That's Megan, MEGHAN.com. You can look this up. There's a really poignant video of Megan and just kind of her journey and family. And so you should definitely read Megan's story, watch the video, and sign up for this group workout class. It sounds like fun, and the walk at Matt Canute Park. I'm wondering about that early diagnosis and, you know, you saying that some people don't get a diagnosis for 4 or 5 years. I've always thought of ALS as a very quickly progressing disease, but is it that because, you know, if someone doesn't get a diagnosis early, they're getting the diagnosis when it's very late in the disease. And it sounds like you probably got an early diagnosis.
Yes, I did get an early diagnosis. And again, it affects people so differently. So I so far have been a slow progressor, but that's not true of everyone. Some people progress much quicker. So it's just, again, there's just not a lot known about this. And so far I've been lucky. And the fact that I'm still walking right now is, I mean, not well, but I'm still walking. And it's probably because I'm so stubborn as well.
Well, then if you go on the ALS forums and, you know, listen to people, so many people, my mom was diagnosed 5 months later, she was dead. You know, I mean, so often that happens. And I think people more, I don't know if younger people, but my age at least, that their the diagnosis is way too late.
Right, right. It just is really confounding to me that there has been no advancement in treatment to speak of, really. I mean, the drug, people are still taking a drug from the 1970s. Is there anything on the horizon? What's the status of ALS and why aren't we figuring it out?
That's a great question. I think ALS is so complex and they still don't know what it is and what's causing it that makes it so complex. So there are two different types of ALS. There's sporadic ALS and there's genetic ALS. And I was diagnosed with genetic ALS, which I remember when they asked me, they're like, do you want to take the genetic test? And I remember talking to the doctors and saying, what are the chances that mine would be genetic considering not one person in my family has ever been diagnosed with ALS? And they're like, well, it's not zero. I'm like, okay, let's do this, whatever. So we did it. The doctor called me and was like, you have genetic ALS. And I was like, that is fascinating. She said, oh, that's not how I thought you would respond. Absolutely fascinating. The fact that my mom has 35 first cousins, not one of them has ever experienced any ALS treatment. My grandmother is 96 years old. All of my grandparents have lived into the 70s, 80s, 90s.
And cousins and everything.
Not one person. So this has been a whole journey of thinking, wow, am I patient zero with this? Was there something between both of my parents that I was so lucky to get that now I have ALS? So, but also the fact that I have genetic ALS and I have two children is also something that we've had to think about and process. And with the amount of awareness that I'm bringing, that other young people are bringing to this disease, my hope is definitely if they come across any signs of ALS in their lives, there'll be a cure by the time that they experience anything.
Well, part of it, sure. FDA and waiting to get approval for anything. And, you know, when Megan was first diagnosed, people were like, oh, well, maybe she could fly to Germany. Maybe she could, you know, we're like, really? You know, sure. How's she going to fly to Germany? How's she going to fly here and there? And because they have a lot more experimental treatments in the, you know, foreign countries, but not here.
Let's talk a moment just about how it's affecting your family dynamic. I mean, when do you tell your young children about stuff like this? When, how do you approach it with your family?
So that was such a hard thing. So I was diagnosed on August 10th, and I did not want to tell the kids because I had no idea how to tell the kids. Like, I'm dying, but hey, I'm going to stay around for as long as I can. I have been so lucky. ALS Northwest is the chapter of the ALS Association that's up here in Portland, Oregon. And they have been amazing. So they sent a social worker out to the house and she brought books and different things and sat with my husband and myself and talked about, okay, this is how you can talk to the kids. This is what we've noticed. And these are the different supports as you get farther into your disease. They have Ski ALS up here, which is an event to raise money for ALS and raise money for patients and just advocacy and treatments and whatever we can do. And it's been an incredible event that I have been really successful in raising money for because of the Park City community. They have stood up and cheered and donated so much money for ALS, which has been amazing. So we were going up for our first Ski ALS in March of that year that I was diagnosed. And I hadn't told the kids yet. And I told my husband, I'm like, okay, we're going to go up and there's going to be people with ALS up there. There's going to be people in a lot of different progressions with ALS. But we have to tell the kids because they're not going to understand what's going on. So we brought the kids in one night and we're like, we need to talk to you. So we sat them down, told them, well, I have ALS and this is my body's going to be shutting down eventually. Like, I'm going to be in a wheelchair at some point. And my daughter, 6, looked at me and said, are you dying today? And I said, no. She said, okay, can I go upstairs? And then my son looked at me, 9. He said, why didn't you tell me earlier? And I was like, oh, this is a really good picture of who my 2 children are. And he was just like, I can't believe you waited to tell me. And I'm like, I know, hon. I didn't know how to tell you. And he's been the one that's had a harder time with, like, my mom is going to be in a wheelchair. Like, I don't want you to lose this. I would run with the kids all the time. They would ride their bikes. I'd push them both in a stroller when they were little, bike with them all the time. So that losing that with them has been one of the hardest things. My son, Ari, is doing cross country right now, which was one of my sports that I did. And he is doing so well. And he's so excited about it. And it's so hard not to be able to participate in that with him. And he's like, I wish you could run with me. I'm like, I know, honey, I do too. I do too. But grandma can run with you. Thank goodness for grandma.
Does it help that your baseline was healthy? That you were kind of a very, you know, strikingly healthy person to begin with?
Absolutely. My PT has said that multiple times. Like, thank goodness you were as strong as you were and have been as strong as you are, because that really helps. Because as your legs, your muscles atrophy, if you're starting at a better, where they're more stronger than they were, then when they atrophy, they're getting to a less devastating point. So,
wow. You know, before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you about the costs that, you know, you're a teacher, so you have good health care, but what happens over and above what insurance covers for you, Megan?
Well, making my house accessible. So we tried to decide, are we going to move or are we going to make our house accessible? And in the market today, it was better just to add on to our house. So we are in construction right now, which with everything going on in the world is very expensive, very long. So we are in the middle of construction. I'm going to have to get everything for downstairs to be able to, a bed, different tools to help me be more independent with everything that I'm doing. We're going to have to eventually get a van, because if I'm going to be wheelchair bound, I'm going to have to be able to get in and out of the car for as long as I can possibly do that. There is expenses so far and wide to be able to do anything and make this life accessible. It's not a cheap, they call this like a rich man's disease, because man, it is very expensive to change your whole entire life to make it more accessible.
Well, and you'll eventually have to stop teaching, which is going to be hard. You know, there goes that insurance and just your life. Megan's house was built over 100 years ago. So you can imagine what that's like. So they had to get special permits even to add on to do that for a day, because there's no bedrooms downstairs and there's just steps and steps outside and, you know, all those things that cost a fortune. And they've got a lift that they're going to be using, but then it costs me thousands of dollars to have someone that's certified to put the lift in, you know, so it just goes on and on and on, which is what we're trying to help out with the fundraiser right now.
This is one of those things, ALS, that, well, first of all, I remember like 15 years ago when they were doing that ice bucket challenge. And, you know, and you think that was so widespread, and it was sort of in the beginning of social media, I think. And I wonder, you know, what good came out of that other than creating awareness, which is good and needed. What can we do if you feel helpless because there's no cure?
So in this disease, it is not incurable. It's just underfunded. There are not enough people who are in the field of ALS. There's not enough people who know about ALS. And so that's exactly what it is. There is no, I believe that the cure is out there. But we just need, we need more money for, we need more people in this field to choose to study ALS. Somebody out there has the answer for what this is. They're out there. It's the money. It's always, unfortunately, money.
And we were saying, I mean, it's horrible that that actor Eric Dane was just diagnosed, but I hate to say it, but more, you know, big awareness of people, and he's been willing to now join with ALS, I am ALS, and it's good for the funding for the disease, because that brings more awareness. And that's what Megan has been doing, is be more awareness. And people are like, she has what? What is that? Oh, I've heard of that, Lou Gehrig. I'm like, mm-hmm, but there's a lot more to it. So yeah, it's awareness and money.
Curious, because I've known several people in the Park City area to have had ALS, and that's how I know about it. Is, do you think there's some bigger preponderance of ALS in this community or something?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of different things that they think could lead to it, being stress, being, I mean, they have a lot of active duty people who are in combat, veterans that have developed ALS, football players have developed ALS. Who knows exactly what it is? There could be something out there. I mean, we all know the mine tailings in Park City. Who knows? I mean, I went to daycare and middle school at Treasure Mountain. So who knows? We don't know. Yeah.
Join Megan and Becky and a lot of Park City community, especially the education community here, all wonderful people. On October 11th, it's 9 to 12, StrongerTogetherForMegan.com. And you can look up the details, but basically it's the Fieldhouse, Basin Rec Fieldhouse, at 9 a.m. on October 11th, Saturday, and afterwards at Matt Canute Park for a nice walk. Megan and Becky, thanks so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. This has been, we're just so proud of you for all the awareness that you're creating and the resilience that you've mustered up. It's just amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Well, Utah recently enacted a statewide law banning cell phones in schools during classroom hours that was effective as of July 1st of this year. This significant policy shift has many families across Utah, including those here in the Park City area, Park City School District, seeking practical guidance. My guest this morning is Devorah Heitner, PhD. She's the author of the acclaimed book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Her work provides invaluable research-backed guidance on raising children in our increasingly connected world, emphasizing mentorship and thoughtful engagement with technology. It's a perfect fit for the conversations, I'm sure, happening at school and at home right here in Summit County. Devorah Heitner, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Well, this is obviously such a timely conversation. You know, my first thought goes to, wow, we as parents, as adults, don't necessarily have to do this, but we are imposing it on our kids. Do you get lots of those kinds of questions?
I think many of us use our phones in so many different ways. It becomes like an appendage. It's an accessibility device. It's how we get directions. It's how we locate the simplest to the most complex of information. It's also how we remember to do things later, like we put things on our calendar. So because we're all so habituated to using our phones for all these purposes, it is a big adjustment to ban phones during the school day, especially for teenagers who may have had a couple of years of kind of learning to rely on these devices for all of these different purposes.
So within this whole world of banning cell phone use in school, you've got varying degrees. There are some schools that will allow, it's just for the time they're in the class, but when they're in between classes, they can use their phones. Some are, you put them in the little pouch and they're locked for the entire day. Some you can use at lunch. I'm wondering, as you have been wading through this world for a long time, what do you see as the most successful program?
Ideally, we're focusing on what we want kids to do and not what we want them not to do. So if we want kids to engage more socially, what are we doing to set up spaces for that to happen? Whether it's middle schools and high schools, you know, going back to having tetherball and checkers available, whether it's schools that are letting kids sit outside for lunch to encourage them to interact in different ways. What are we doing to encourage young people to interact, if that's the worry, right? Because there are a number of worries people talk about. Another worry and a reason cell phones have been banned in so many places in schools, even districts around the country, as well as states like Utah, is distraction. So what are we doing to promote on-task focused behavior? What are we doing to intrigue and excite and engage kids with class? If we stick with, you know, for example, like boring lectures or a strategy we know doesn't work, then they'll find another way to be distracted, even if they don't have their phones, particularly since almost all schools have other devices like iPads or Chromebooks in play, right? So it's not like kids are device free during the day, they're just phone free. So if we don't think about how are we making school more engaging, or how are we allowing kids to connect better with one another, we're not really doing our jobs. Just taking something away isn't enough. And whether or not we take that thing away, we could still be thinking about building more engagement, both with the curriculum and with kids in their communities.
We know as adults that we are more distracted because of our phones. And oftentimes we don't have the creativity to create activities for ourselves, you know, because we've trained ourselves to be constantly distracted by cell phones. What role do parents have in this? You know, if we're going to be successful parents, and if this program is going to be successful of banning cell phone use during the day, how do you further kind of what you were just talking about regarding parents and how they can support this?
Well, parents are going to need to be thoughtful models about how to use technology and mentoring and leading by example, whether it's not texting and driving in front of kids or ever because it's illegal and unsafe, whether it's thinking about putting our devices away long before bedtime to promote positive sleep hygiene, whether it's rethinking our use of certain apps and even talking to our kids about, hey, you know, I had a little bit of an unhealthy habit of scrolling Zillow to think about escape from my life, but it's really interfering with me getting work done. So I took the app off my phone, and really modeling that for our kids. Also, if our kids are using us as a reminder or executive function throughout the day, and a lot of times our kids are very connected to us, maybe we're texting them, hey, you know, how did your test go? Or can I pick you up after school at this time? Or they're texting us, can you remind me to bring my uniform tomorrow? They're not going to have that kind of access, right, anymore. So if they're not supposed to have their phones out during the day, we should restrain ourselves from the urge to contact. And if they contact us, we should retrain ourselves and avoid responding immediately, because that just encourages that habit. Ideally, we're busy with our own activities during the day, our own work, our own community connections, our own caregiving, whatever we're doing when our kids are at school, and they're busy with school, and we shouldn't be texting with them kind of constantly. And so that's a big adjustment for some families, and it just becomes an easy habit for kids, again, to reach out, and sometimes for parents to reach out to kids. And teachers tell me that it's quite distracting, and sometimes they'll sort of bust a kid for texting in class, and they'll say, well, it's my mom, right? And ideally, we're not the cause of our child getting in trouble in school for using their phone when they're not supposed to. So we need to model that. We may need to teach kids how to keep a paper calendar. If they're at a school that has a very strict restriction and they really can't get out their phone throughout the day to record assignments, for example, and they've habituated to doing that, they may need to learn how to either keep a calendar on their school device, like a Chromebook or a laptop, so still a digital calendar that even might sync with their phone, so they might still have access to that in the evenings. Or they may need to learn to use a paper assignment notebook, which might seem very basic, but if your kid has never done that, they may need to be shown how do I track all of this stuff in a notebook? What do you mean write it down, right? And where do I keep the thing that I've written down? How do I avoid losing it? So these are skills we may need to actually proactively teach our kids.
Have some schools decided to give out a planner that you write in, you know, as a means to not always use your calendar on your phone?
It varies. Some schools probably are still doing that. And kids who have certain plans in place or might have a class during their day that's focused on study skills. But what you see is some students get that support maybe because they have a 504 or an IEP, but maybe all students, including students who don't have an identified learning need or difference, might still need that support. Again, even if they're handing them out, unless they're really showing kids how to use them, if kids were, for example, went through middle school or elementary school not using something like that, and then they became reliant on their phone or voice memos or other reminders, and we're taking that tool away, we need to give them and proactively teach another tool. And parents may want to sort of check but verify. Like if your kid's doing great, then they probably have a system that works. And it might just be a matter of curiosity, like, oh, show me what your system is. Maybe I could learn from you. If your kid is struggling, you may want to help them develop a new system because it's not working. And there's all kinds of reasons why phones can be really great accessibility devices. That's why I'm concerned a little bit about bans. I think bans can do some things to help teachers, and bans can make it easier for schools to have a uniform culture. But I think if we don't take some special care for students who may have been using a phone as a translation device, as a wayfinding device, or as a way to record their assignments and set reminders throughout the day of things they need to do, and we don't help students with those accessibility needs, then we're creating new problems that we might not have anticipated.
Well, as you were talking, it was making me think about, in our school district anyway, this is just, the ban is just for 6th through 12th grade. So of course I thought about, what about before 6th grade? What are we doing to prepare those students for a world of not having their cell phone in use? And I don't know what the, you know, I know a lot of parents try to wait until the child is 13 before they get a smartphone, but what are you seeing, because you are a professional in this world, in terms of the younger kids?
There's a huge variety. A lot of little kids have access to a connected device at home that does a lot of the things that phones do. So parents will very confidently say to me, oh, I'm waiting till 8th. And I'm like, that's cool. What's your kid doing right? What's your third grader doing right now? And they're like, oh, they're on Roblox. And I'm like, oh, what games? And they're like, what do you mean? Are there multiple games in Roblox? I'm like, yeah. And it's a public server. Who are they talking to on Roblox? Right. And so if your kid is using the internet, I think of that as the milestone that we really need to focus on and help kids use the internet safely. If they're playing a public, you know, a server-based game like Roblox, where they can play with anyone in the world from your home in second, third, fourth grade, that needs to be mentored and thought about. You want to consider what games you might want to put that in a public, you know, that device in a public space in your home so you can hear who your child's interacting with. You may not want them on headphones. You may want to delay a game that's public server based and choose games where you, with your child, choose and buy the actual, you know, cartridge, and you're playing a game that you purchase and chose, as opposed to whatever game your kid sort of stumbles on in an online space. So those are just some questions. And then the watches, teachers in elementary schools all over the country tell me that the watches are quite distracting, that kids are texting home, that it can increase anxiety, especially when they hear a lot from parents. So sometimes we think, oh, I'll be more connected with my kid. It will reduce anxiety. But in fact, for some kids, for many kids, the possibility of connecting at home can actually increase anxiety and reduce the sort of focus on being in the environment that they're in and navigating that environment, right? If you can text your parents throughout the school day. So the watches are a little tricky and honestly, in some ways can be even more sort of insidious or problematic than phones, because they're right on your body. They're hard to ignore. It's not something that you're going to put away in your locker for the day. So those are some considerations for elementary school. And then also, what happens outside of school still affects school, whether kids are interacting positively or negatively on Minecraft or in a group text. Even if they're not texting on their own phones, they may be connecting, for example, on a school-based shared document like Google Docs, and they're chatting in there. And that's not a bad thing, but we need to support kids in connecting appropriately. So if they are chatting on Google Docs and it goes wrong and gets mean, that doesn't mean, oh my goodness, we need to lock down Google Docs. It does mean that we need to teach kids how to interact appropriately and to remind them that they're accountable for how they act in digital spaces, and that there are real people on the other end of this interaction. It's not just like I'm typing into the void. Just like there's a real person, if you taunt someone at recess, that's a real person who's going to have feelings. If you taunt someone in Google Docs, it's also a real person. So we're teaching kids to be accountable for their digital behavior for years before they have a phone.
Yeah, interesting. Well, last year during the 2024-25 school year, our junior high school here in the Park City area ran a pilot program ahead of this ban coming into place. And according to the school district, they say it was really successful. It resulted in a 72% reduction in behavioral incidents at the junior high school compared to the previous year, and that teachers saw increased student focus and had more productive instructional time. Now, that's coming from the district. What are some of the things that you actually, I mean, is this something that you're like, yes, this is what we've seen?
I have heard that. And I was at a conference of school resource officers, and one of the challenges that can happen with phones, unfortunately, is that kids will record altercations and fights, and that can actually encourage that behavior or encourage, it can certainly amplify the impact of a conflict. So you might have had two students having a fight after school or in the bathroom, and a few students would hear about it. But if it gets recorded, it amplifies the harm that's caused. Unfortunately, human nature, it might even provide a motivation to have a fight. It might have students taking out their phones to record a fight instead of intervening or going to get help. There's all kinds of ways that something like violence can be exacerbated. The flip side is you have kids who are bullied, who use their phones to record what happens to be able to seek recourse and justice. So phones can be used in multiple ways. Some of them are really good and positive and can help people. Some of them can be negative. But when schools see results like that, it's also hopefully because they're doing positive community changes. So it's not what we just took away phones and everything was much better. I'm curious if there were other steps that they took to build community. And some of those steps could be taken whether or not we take away phones. In other words, it's not just the phones, right? It's also what does taking away the phones make possible? If taking away the phones makes it possible for teachers to just focus on other pro-social activities, et cetera, you know, helping the kid who's isolated at recess or at lunch, especially in middle school, they still have eyes on our kids socially and emotionally at that age. And how are they integrating into the community? School counselors, maybe running groups that help kids. We're still seeing some, I think, effects, and I'm hearing from schools that we're seeing effects from the pandemic still on kids socially. So the kids who are in middle school now who started school later because of the pandemic or didn't go in person to, you know, kindergarten or first grade, still may be missing some conflict resolution skills and other things. Just taking away the phones may help a little, but what I'd like to see schools doing is actually proactively engaging kids on these social skills and giving them a lot of opportunity. The other thing we don't want to see is them just taking away time for kids to interact. They need recess. Recess should be, I mean, ideally, I wish there was recess in high school, but certainly through middle school, there should be recess. Kids need that time.
Yeah. So again, here in the Park City School District, it's bell to bell that you have locked your phones in. I forget, what are the pouches called?
Yonder pouches. And I'm sure Yonder and any other company that makes these things are doing really well right now with all the bands.
Really well. Yeah. And also I wanted to ask you about this. I know our Education Foundation, the philanthropy arm of sort of how we support programs that aren't otherwise funded by a pretty sparse budget from Utah, from the state of Utah, paid for this. So it was about $60,000 to get these pouches. What are school districts doing that can't afford that? I mean, are they not enacting these bans, or are they
in New York State? Schools are getting money from the state for the bans. So they're providing money. I'm guessing in other states, and I don't know, other than New York, I'm not familiar with the amounts or how much, but many states I think are supporting the bans in some way. The problem also is the more you focus on sort of enforcement and turning schools and teachers sort of into cops of this, I think the more we get away from a focus, again, on kids and their well-being, right? And so we don't want to just overly focus on, I think, the Yonder pouches, for example, because what happens is then there will be kids who will bring a fake phone and put it in the pouch. The most important thing is, do we see kids interacting with teachers in positive ways with one another? Are they learning? If they can put it away for the day, however they do that, and they're engaging with one another and with school, that's the positive result that we want to see. It shouldn't be so much of a focus on what is the fancy equipment we're using to, you know, lock this down. And certainly some families may use the bans as a reason to delay giving their kids a phone, especially in middle school when, you know, a lot of families might have thought sixth grade or seventh grade was the time. And maybe they'll say, oh, my kid's only going to get in trouble at school with this anyway. Maybe we just delay. I think it's really important for those families to recognize that even if you're delaying a phone, kids still have a digital life. And we want to teach them how to have a thoughtful and appropriate way of interacting with friends, again, in server-based games, in shared documents at school, in all of the places, if their friend has a YouTube channel, you know, even if they are using their digital camera, for example, do they know that they should be asking permission before they take someone's picture and share? Do they know that they can say no to sharing their contact information with someone? We need to give kids digital literacy. Do they know how to write an email to their teacher appropriately with a salutation and an appropriate subject line and asking questions in a thoughtful way? So I think sometimes we lean into bans and delay. And again, we don't teach kids how to use these tools thoughtfully and appropriately. So a sixth grader should be able to write a simple email to a teacher. A 10th grader should be able to write an email inquiring about a job or a scholarship. when we just lock kids down and we don't focus on teaching them skills, we miss really crucial opportunities. And we risk kids going around us and not telling us if there's a problem. If I'm being bullied on TikTok, but technically I'm not supposed to even have TikTok, then can I tell my parents?
Right. I wanted to ask you what teachers are saying about this. We ask so much of teachers. And in a sense, while this should be heaven sent for teachers because they've got kids paying attention, we're also asking them to teach these skills that maybe haven't been taught before. What are you hearing there?
Teachers are mostly on board with this from what I've heard and from what I've seen. Teachers do feel like it's hard to compete with TikTok. It's hard to compete with YouTube. Teachers who are using phones in thoughtful and appropriate ways in the classroom may be frustrated. Like if they're using QR codes, if they're having kids document the stage they're at of their science experiment or their robotics build with phones, they may need to come up with other tools for kids to do some of the same things that they were using their phones for. So I have talked to teachers who feel like, please trust me to use this tool appropriately and thoughtfully. And why are you making this decision for me? I will say I've also talked to a lot of teachers who feel like it's a relief not to have to have an individual policy. Now, it's not like before bans, teachers didn't have policies and schools didn't have policies. Most schools weren't saying, kids, be on TikTok all day. It's fine. We don't care, right? That was not the policy at any schools last year or the year before or at any time. For years, there have been policies. But for teachers to not feel like, oh, you know, Mr. So-and-so across the hall is doing something different than me, and then I become the bad guy if the state or the school has a uniform policy, that sets me up to not have to have this conversation over and over again with individual kids. Again, what we don't want to see is this turning kids into sort of criminals. Like, we don't want to cause kids to get in trouble. If a kid is in a situation where they're a caregiver for a sibling or a parent and they're getting texts throughout the school day, we want to be curious about that kid's situation before we go and just like give a kid an in-school suspension or, you know, a serious consequence that has real implications for them for using their phone. It would be worth finding out, like, is this kid being bullied? Is this kid in a caregiving role? Is there a reason that they feel really anxious about, or, you know, do they have clinical anxiety, right? Or is there a reason they feel really anxious about parting with their phone or being disconnected? And what can we do to support that child rather than just purely taking a punitive approach? Right. Of course, there are kids who are just going to try to sneak it because it's distracting and fun. And there are even kids who have said, I'm grateful that more other kids are friendly. And, you know, I'm talking more with other students. I'm seeing that as well. Students saying, I'm relieved that not everyone's on their phone. I'm not looking at the top of my friends' heads when I sit at lunch with them. We're all talking to one another. So I think there are definitely students who are on board with this, but other students who will struggle. And we don't want to use these bans as a way to turn those students into, you know, troublemakers, or without being curious again about how to help them unhook from whatever's going on, if it's just a distraction issue, and if it's a more serious issue where they feel like they need to be connected, what can we do to support them?
Yeah, that's such a good point. And it makes me wonder, I know several young people in my orbit who have anxiety, and when they're especially in public places and groups of people that who they don't know, they hold their phone there and they are on their phone. And so you do have to give them some other tool, you know, for these kinds of situations. What are you telling parents and even kids about, you know, what else to do?
Ideally, schools are increasing their support with counseling in the recent years with mental health struggles, with the period coming out of the pandemic, so that kids can make a plan. Like, can I draw in my notebook if I feel anxious? Can I do one hard thing? Can I try sitting next to someone? Can I try one activity, right? And then if I need a break, do I have a chill out pass? Can I go out in the hallway if I really need to? Can I go sit in the counselor's office for, you know, a specific period of time? Can I try a breathing exercise, right? We want to equip kids with a bunch of tools. The fact is, again, they do have their devices with them. So many kids will retreat then into their school device and use their school device in a way that may or may not be helpful or focused on school, right? They may go surf the internet on their school device, for example, or even, you know, use some of the social apps that we're trying to, you know, get them off of on their phone. So yeah. I think it's important to have a device policy that's not just a phone policy, that really focuses on how are we using devices at school in an educational and thoughtful way, that we're not saying, okay, if you finish your work, you can play on your iPad now, right? Because those kinds of ways of using tech really undermine the educational mission of using tech to create, to collaborate, right? If we're using tech more passively, scrolling, for example, that's not a positive use of technology either in our leisure time or at school. So what can we do to help kids and teachers really use tech for its highest and best purpose, which is to enhance our learning as an accessibility device, as a space that we can collaborate in really innovative ways? I mean, I think the Google Doc, to come back to that, is an incredible tool, right? I've worked with numerous editors on my books, and having something like a Google Doc or similar where we can be in the same document and collaborate together, I wish I had had that in school, right? We haven't talked about AI yet, but that's another challenge, is just academic honesty and how are schools proactively teaching that. And getting rid of the phones does not get kids off of ChatGPT. If kids are using ChatGPT for classwork or schoolwork or other AI tools, we need to help them understand why that's a problem. And again, we need to take the focus out of sort of catching them and into teaching them, is this an appropriate tool for this task? Is this an honest tool? If it's not, I shouldn't be using it. There's so many ethical implications there. I don't want to take us too far down that road, but it's really important to talk with kids about it and not think, oh, we've gotten rid of phones, so we don't need to have that conversation.
For parents struggling with not being able to text their kids during the day, parents think, you know, not on board with this.
Well, I think parents are worried about violence at school. And I think there are other things that shouldn't be in school, like, or maybe so accessible, like guns, that would reduce the fear of violence in school, and that would significantly reduce parent worries about needing to reach their kids. So I think that's a huge policy issue, and taking phones out of school is scary to parents for that reason, which is a horrifying reality we live with as Americans that most people in the world don't live with in the same way, sending their kids to school and worrying about a shooting, right? So that's a huge issue. But in terms of the day-to-day contact, or, you know, I need to reach my kid about after school, think about the solutions your parents were comfortable with. Think about the ways your kids had resilience, that you had resiliency when somebody wasn't there to pick you up, right? And yeah. So many people my age and older, I'm sort of, you know, Gen X, remember the time where you got left behind or you had to figure out what to do. And our kids have sort of never had to troubleshoot that. So one thing we need to do is equip our kids with advocacy skills. You know, equip your fourth grader to go to the office and say, excuse me, may I call my dad? Right? And by the way, if they don't know anybody's phone number, the office in an elementary school should have a couple of contact numbers for a kid, but they should be memorizing a few numbers too. It's okay to teach a fourth grader, like, this is your babysitter's number, this is your aunt's number. Like, most of them are not going to remember 10 numbers, but they should have at least two or three phone numbers that they know them. So teaching kids that advocacy, if they get separated from you at the mall, what are they going to do, right? We don't want to teach kids to be so afraid of strangers that they can't get help in a situation, and the only thing they could do is if they have their watch, because what if their watch runs out of batteries? Right? A lot of parents are GPS tracking their kids as well. And that is also driving up anxiety and can undermine kids' learning of, you know, who is an appropriate person to ask for directions if I take a new bus today and I get lost. Right. So we need to equip our kids with strategies to deal with getting through a day, even if they don't have something they need, even if they have to borrow it from a friend, right? Or even if they have to sort of make it through. And schools are going to need to make offices accessible. I mean, one thing that's true is it's gotten a lot harder to reach anyone at schools in the cell phone years because there's not always somebody working in the office. So the flip side is they are going to need to make sure that if a parent calls school, someone answers the phone.
Devorah Heitner, PhD, is my guest. She's the author of the book Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. And she's helping us here in the Park City School District kind of manage our way and navigate these waters with a cell phone ban that came into effect really as of this school year. Devorah, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW, The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.